You're listening to In the Drink with me, Joe Campanelli. I'm really excited to bring you this third and last of the special pre-taped episodes. And for this episode, I spoke with Michael Cruz back in May. Michael Cruz is the winemaker of Cruz Wine Company, which is a small winery and custom crush facility in Petaluma, California. And he also makes the wines for Ultramarine, which I think are some of the very greatest sparkling wines, not just in California or America, but maybe the world. I love Ultramarine wines. They're super hard to find, but if you can ever find them, they are a treat. And Cruz Wine Company, we carry those regularly at my restaurant, Fausto. Michael is such an interesting guy. He has such a great perspective on the industry, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Michael, thank you so much for coming on In the Drink. I'm just so excited to have you on as our guest today.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
I feel like it's overdue. I'm such a fan of your wines and your work. And I feel bad that we're chatting under these circumstances and not in person. But I really appreciate you making the time.
I've been a big fan for a long time, so I'm really glad for this opportunity to talk to you.
I've always thought of you as someone who is able to experiment, but then still create these wines that don't seem experimental. Is experimentation part of one of your values? I feel like you often try to.
Yeah. No. I think you're right. Actually, I think that's a really interesting way to put it. I don't know that I've ever thought about it that way. Like, I'm going to misrepresent the quote or misspeak the quote, but in Steve Martin's seminal work, The Man with Two Brains, he says, when he's talking about science, he says something like, I like the gooey stuff, you know? And I think for me, the reason why I got into science was I liked the technical things. I was a biochemist, and I was always, when I got out of science is when I started getting away from the hand lab work and more into like the biophysics and the more math side of things. And that's where I sort of got off the train, to be honest, because I was like, if I can't like actually do stuff, you know, I come from a kind of a long line of mechanics, and you know, I don't have any familial background in this stuff. Once I started moving away from that, I was like, it's not interesting for me anymore. And I think that the thing I liked about winemaking was, I think people overstate the science of it. It's not a particularly scientific craft, but it is still a craft. And I think that that was the thing that really interested me. And the experimental side is a really interesting way to put it, because I've always wanted to do experiments, especially with sparkling. I think that was the big thing for me. With sparkling wine, there's always been a focus on trying a bunch of different things, but it was a bunch of different things to get to a more refined technique. So if you took the Pet Nats, for example, my goal with the Pet Nats was always, how do we do this such that the finished wine, while not imperceptibly different from traditional method, that's not the point, but how do we make it so that the method is so clean that we're just getting a different version of sight, if that's not too esoteric to say? Like, how do we sort of polish the technique so that we get there? And that's where the experiment is coming from, I think.
And I think that a lot of times when you hear people say that a scientist might be involved in the winemaking, yeah, I think people might conjure images of a very manipulated sort of wine. Right. I've heard winemakers say that the bigger and more well-equipped the lab at a winery, the worse the wines are, the more manipulated going to be. One of the things that you managed to do is, you know, have that science background, but they don't seem like they're not manipulated wines. How do you accomplish that?
Well, I mean, Jules Chauvet was a microbiologist, right? Let's be honest. So if we're going to talk about it that way, I think we should give props to like one of the first guys. You know, Terry Layton was my 110L lab teacher at Cal. So if you've ever had the Kalen wines and stuff like that, like, he's a scientist too. He taught the yeast portion. And I think it was funny, I saw him at Food and Wine one year, and I came up to him. I was like, you know, Terry, you inspired me and like all this stuff. And he's like, huh, I don't remember you at all. And I was like, oh, thanks, bud. That class had like 40 people in it. Anyway, I didn't leave a great impression. But I think you're right. I think the thing is that science, you know, you create a hypothesis and you test it, right? And you take a variable and you change the variable and you go from there. wine, there's so many variables. I mean, there really is so many. And I think, you know, when I first transitioned to wine making, I signed up for Davis's master's program. And I, you know, talked to a couple of people in one of the labs there. And I was really excited because, without getting super geeky, some of the phenolic work that Adams was doing, I really was interested in that. And then I just took a year off before I started, and I started working. And it took me like 3 months to realize, oh, there's no science in this at all. I mean, no, like, pure science anyway. And once I did that, I just told Davis, hey, I'm not coming. Don't worry about it. And I just started working. And I think that it's too combinatorial. That's what I'm trying to say with winemaking, is that you can't pick one thing. And, you know, if we're in Piedmont or something, you can't pick one thing about Nebbiolo to test to see if you're going to make a great Nebbiolo down the line. Like, there's 1,000 things, and they're all little variable things. So the best we can do is sort of refine our technique to this super fine edge, so that when we do want to make a wine that is without additives or speaks of sight or is the purest representation of something, that our techniques are ready for that process when the grapes are ready.
Okay, I do have a geeky question for you.
Sure.
You know, you have this custom crush, and uh-huh. I know for your wines, you like to do an ambient yeast fermentation. And so yeah. If you're getting grapes in from, I don't know how many different sources, yeah. How are you able to make sure that the yeast that are fermenting any particular wine come from that fruit, or are you able to do that?
I would say the reality is you're not. And I think that it's a better way to think about native ferments, for lack of a better word, are you have an aerobic phase and then you have the Saccharomyces phase. Okay. So the aerobic phase would be that first 1 to 4% alcohol fermentation. And generally speaking, that's not Saccharomyces that's doing it. It's Clethora, it's Haniospora, it's all these little apical yeasts or these aerobic yeasts that are like on the surface of the yeast. Those we can't really get rid of, provided our sulfur levels are low or non-existent. Those are just going to do their thing. That part is always going to be from the vineyard. The rest of it, the Saccharomyces part, some people will argue and say that that's from the vineyard too. I'm less convinced of that. And I think that for the most part, the dominant strain that ferments that is going to be what's ever around. And, you know, for us, for reds, we ferment our reds nearly exclusively in concrete. Well, we're never sanitizing those. Maybe at the end of harvest we are, or before harvest, but certainly not between fills. So that's not stainless. There's plenty of surfaces for stuff to grow on there. And the first time you fill it, it takes, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days before the Saccharomyces is really taking over. The second time you fill it, it could be a day and a half. So you've already kind of built up that load. The other thing I'd say is that because we do traditional method sparkling, we do have a lot of Saccharomyces that is from the lab, but we use a very traditional and very common yeast strain from Champagne that I think probably 95% of producers use. It's EC1118 for those who want to know. Prédimus, whatever. And that yeast is probably all over in the rafters, on our feet, whatever. So I guess for me, the ambient part is not exactly worrying about which Saccharomyces is starting it, but sort of what that first, you know, 1 to 3% alcohol, where that's coming from, and sort of how much time are these surface yeasts sort of breaking down and, you know, releasing all the like flavor progenitor molecules. for a guy who's not talking about science, I'm talking about science a lot, but you know what I mean? Like, that's sort of the important part for me.
Have there been any changes to the custom crush side of your business? Have you seen the same sort of demand? Have you had to interact with those clients in any different way?
Well, you mean specifically because of COVID?
Correct.
Yeah. So it's been funny. Like, that's been the big change for us, is that we used to have a very open, I mean, it's their wine, you know, they can come by and taste and everything like that. And now it's like, nope, nobody else is in here. If you want a sample, we'll pull samples for you. We'll do whatever you want. But for the most part, like, you just stay away. And it is interesting. You know, we have the custom crush side for us. It used to be almost half of our production. In the beginning, it was 80% of our production, you know, but that's come down a little bit to where cruise and ultramarine is probably 60% of what we do now. And it's been a sort of a natural progression. I mean, to be honest, with sales the way they are, I wish we had more custom crush now, but it's okay. I mean, we'll be okay on that front.
You said something earlier that I thought was really interesting about trying to maybe explore terroir through pet gnats. And I wonder if you can tell us, how do you think pet gnats can showcase terroir? How is that different from champagne method wine?
Right. So I'll pull up a little bit further from that conversation for a second and say that I think for me, my interest in sparkling wine in general, although I think I got into sparkling wine, honestly, just because it was difficult. That really was it. It just seemed like a hard thing to do. And I was like, I like doing hard things. Let's see what happens. And then when I started to actually know what I was doing, which I'm not even sure I'm there yet, but you know, I've been making sparkling wine for almost 12 years now. And I think that like by year, I don't know, 6 or 7, I started to believe that, oh, actually we can use traditional method to sort of examine site in a different way. And the first pet gnat we made was actually for Hardy. Hardy no longer makes wine at the winery, but he did starting in 13, I think. We did a pet gnat for him and it was good. It was good and it was clean. And I don't think I had any sort of aspirations to make something very terroir based, but I think what I wanted to do is I wanted to make something that was where the technique was really transparent. So after that, I started working with the Rancho Chamiles Valdeguay as a sparkler as well. And there was something about it. Like it just tasted so pure and clean and it tasted of fruit and minerality. And I thought, well, that's funny because outside of like, I don't know, maybe Le Capriot or someone like that, to me, all the pet gnats had always been very, very cidery beer like, right? And I don't mean that as any kind of, you know, shit talking. It was just more that was kind of my experience. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that all of the sparkling techniques that we use are all kind of interconnected, right? So if I was really interested in, so the Deming Vineyard is a vineyard in Calistoga, Valier Vineyard, and as a still wine, it's kind of thin, rosé-like, it's fine, but it doesn't feel like a Napa site to me, if that makes sense. As a pet gnat, though, it has a little bit more weight, a little more kind of Venus character, and it started to feel like, oh, this tastes of Napa, it tastes of Calistoga in some way. And I think that sort of by focusing on using sort of an aggressive press cut, an aggressive sort of disgorging setup and sort of a little bit of longer time on lees, we were sort of teasing out some of the more Venice character of the wine. And I don't mean to say that it was accidental that we got to the sort of site-driven pet gnat, but it was more like I was so informed by the traditional method that that's sort of how that arose, if that makes sense.
It does. And I mean, I love it because, you know, pet gnat, it can be a style in which the style for me sometimes overtakes the terroir. And I think you've proven that you can showcase terroir through that.
Well, and I think it was the Loire. I mean, I think that's the thing. It was sort of the Loire producers more than it was the domestic producers that sort of, again, it sounds like I'm talking trash, but it was sort of those guys that kind of pointed me in that direction more. And I think the only thing that I sort of wanted to play with is I just wanted the carbonation to be a little bit higher. That was kind of my thing from the beginning, is I always wanted to be really heavily carbonated and basically dry and clear. And that was sort of the three kind of caveats that we kind of operate in. And I was like, oh, if it's like that, then it tastes more like, you know, wine, I guess.
Without getting too technical, how do you accomplish that?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, it's just kind of watching the fermentation and then being really careful about pressing. I mean, it's sort of funny, but with sparkling wine, if you think about it, putting the bubbles aside, and obviously that's almost all of it. But if you take that out, pressing is basically the only kind of winemaking decision you have in there. And I think that sort of, if we were talking to Schramsberg or Roederer or someone like that, they would be telling you that about their sparkling wine. So what I'm saying about doing that, applying it to pet gnat, it's not anything surprising. I didn't figure anything out. It was just more like, well, let's take that level of serious intent and apply it to the pet gnat. So that was really it.
And when you say pressing is the only question, is that to press or not to press? What type of press to use? How much you're extracting?
Yeah, it's more that. It's more like, you know, how do we press? How slowly do we press? You know, what press do we use? Things like that. And I think that when you come and visit us in the winery, you'll see like the press that we have. You know, when I think to those days, I guess I bought that press in 2012 and I found I was going through some old files and I have the check, the copy of the check that I wrote the deposit for. And it was more money than I've ever had in any bank account ever. And I wrote it as a friggin' check to this company that was going to make it in Germany, you know. And I just think, like, God, I was so cocky. But but it was important to me at the time. And I think that I'm glad I didn't skimp on that, I guess.
You make the Valdiguer grape in both a still dry red and a pet nat.
Yeah.
I wonder what has attracted you to this grape.
I mean, kind of going back to what we were talking about before, about the sort of like blue collar-y kind of idea of winemaking, or I mean, Valdiguer is a workman's grape. I mean, it crops really well. It has, I don't want to say no disease pressure, but very minimal disease pressure. And it's very hard to make it overripe. I mean, it holds its acid really well. And to me, it always just tasted like California. I mean, Zinfandel tastes like California, obviously. I mean, that's the historic model. Carignan, to me, can, in good vineyards, taste of California. But there's something about that kind of fruity raspberry brightness in Valdiguer that I always felt like this should be our Pinot Noir, you know, for any place that's not coastal, because it just is so, it's just such a pleasure to make and to drink. I will say it's not specifically like the most terroir transparent grape, because aromatically it's so strong, but it is still super sensitive to farming. So I think as long as you farm it well, I think it reaps a lot of rewards.
Why did you think it would make a good candidate for a pet nat? And what sort of grapes are good candidates for pet nats?
That's an interesting question. I used to have like a very, again, in sort of my years, I used to have like a very straight answer to that. And I would basically say, if the grape is very aromatic, then it's better for pet nat than it is for traditional. So things like Muscat or Valdiguer or even Saint Laurent compared to Pinot Noir, right? Saint Laurent tends to have more nose than Pinot Noir does. I think that's still basically true, but I would also say it sort of depends. I mean, you can play around either way, but for me, I think that's basically the case. I think what's so attractive about pet nats is that things that are generally more grapey tasting do great as pet nats. Like I would love to do, for clients, we've done Pinot Noir actually as a pet nat, and it can be great. I would love to play around with like Zinfandel, for example, because I think it would be awesome as a pet nat, which is sort of a crazy thing to say, but I think it's true. Anything that is sort of like high acid, maybe simple body, but really pretty on the nose is a good candidate.
Like if you made a white Zinfandel pet nat.
Oh my God. You're just
swimming in money with that.
I love it. I'm so into the idea of it. I it's funny. It's a wine I've yet to make because I just feel like there's so many, I don't know, maybe it's my vanity, but there's so many people that are so good at making Zinfandel that I don't really want to swim in that pool, I guess. But something like that would be outstanding. I'd love to do it. I'll ask the Bedrock boys. Maybe they can loan me a little bit of Zin and see what we can do.
Those wines are great. For traditional method sparkling wines, people often talk about how important having a Von Clare or having grapes with good acidity, how important acidity is for making that style of sparkling wines. Is it equally as important for a pet nat?
I think so. What I've sort of found over the years, I think, is that I think when I started, I sort of assumed that acidity was kind of the be-all, end-all for sparkling wine, maybe just generally. And I think for the first level of interaction with sparkling wine, I think that's probably true. But I think we have to be careful about sort of like lemon water syndrome, you know what I mean? Where basically you have lemon water and you just have bubbles in it. You know, you want some sight, you want some character. And there's amazing sparkling wines that, from Champagne too, that if you took a pH meter and you measured it, you'd be shocked by how high some of the pH is, especially like the Pinot Meuniers and stuff like that. But yeah, I've always found it to be important. And I think that with wine, if we can be slightly esoteric for a second, I think, and maybe a little more hand wavy than esoteric, but when you talk about wine, I think you want to talk about sort of the tactile sensation in your mouth. And I think, you know, with red wine, you have tannin. With white wine, maybe you could say you have body. With sparkling wine, you have bubbles, but also the acid sort of drives the texture. So I always think about like, how does the acid sort of create a textural response in your mouth? And I think that's why with pet nats, it's important to have acid on some level, you know, and then that's well integrated into the wine.
With science, you have this hypothesis and you do experiments and you prove or disprove your hypothesis. And it's very measurable and you need to be able to repeat it in different settings, right? With wine, it seems that not everything is so cut and dry. Yeah. There's so many factors. Maybe there's even some sort of magical or mysticism with wine. Do you agree with that assessment of it? Does that draw you to it?
100%. It's funny because that's not the question I thought you were going to ask, which is sort of funny, but based on what we were just talking about, but 100% that's true. And I think take champagnes, for example, and let's say we just take Clos de Manille, right? And we just plop it out of the ground and we put it at Hirsch, right? We just, you know, we take a block of Hirsch that's not planted and we just put Clos de Manille right there. It's what, 1.8 hectare? We can find a spot for it, right? That wine is going to taste so crazily different, right? And sure, you could say climate and all that stuff. But I mean, even if you transported the soil and everything else, like the wine would be unrecognizable as being from the same spot. And I think that like that part is not just true, but actually quite attractive to me, kind of. Do you know what I mean? And I think that like one of the things that's been so interesting for me is that I think essentially I am a Francophile in a lot of ways in terms of sort of learning from Champagne and stuff like that, but I've never wanted to make Champagne, if that makes sense. Like all I cared about was sort of taking their techniques, which are time-honored, hundreds of years old, whatever, and sort of use them here. And I never was aspirational in terms of saying like, I want to make Clos de Manille or I want to make Krug or something like that. Well, first off, that would be an insane thing to say anyway, but the point still stands. Like I've never had like, oh, I want Ultramarine to be a California Krug. Do you know what I mean? I more wanted to say like, okay, here's what Fred and Jerome and Alex are doing. How can I apply those techniques with Charlie Heinz's site? And what do I get when that happens? Right. That's really been my sort of MO. And I think that's where we push away from the science and go into the technique, the craftsmanship, if you want to put it that way.
What was the question you thought I was going to ask you?
Well, what I thought you were going to ask me was, because you started with the science and I was thinking like, and I mentioned the pH thing, is I thought you were going to call me out and say something to the effect of like, well, don't you use science to sort of figure out and reverse engineer what other people are doing? And that is probably true on some level. I will admit that. And I will say that like we do, when you were talking before about like the lab, for a winery that makes, you know, 8,000 cases of wine, maybe. I mean, I'm talking Cruz, Ultramarine, like in a big year, we have way more lab equipment than anybody would has any right to do. But it's been more like that's come out of my curiosity about things. It hasn't come out of like me trying to figure out how to make wine this way or that.
I wonder how your own personal wine drinking has changed during this time. Have you been drinking more, drinking less, drinking different wines?
Wow, that's a great question. So, you know, Jasmine Hirsch and I are together and whatever. So we've been culling the cellar on levels that are almost unprecedented, I would say. I've probably been drinking more, I would say. But I also would say it's better wine than I would drink normally. I think our normal plan on things would be we just pull stuff out and just drink it. Or maybe she's working on a blend and I'm working on a blend and we kind of keep it work related. But now I think all the sort of crazy bottles that, you know, maybe we would be posting from travels are now just being consumed at home. Or maybe it's like, oh, it's, you know, I randomly bought 4 different bottles of, you know, Italian wine that Mark Coleman told me to buy or something. And now let's see what they taste like or something. It's been a lot more like that. So yeah, it's funny. A real conversation occurring in our households, and my guess is in a lot of households, is like, okay, but Thursday we're going to take off, right? Or something like that. You know what I mean? Like we have to have some days where it's like dry-ish, you know.
Has that happened?
I mean, sort of.
Yeah, I imagine between the two of you, your cellar's pretty deep, so you don't really need to buy too much wine at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, to be fair, I've bought a lot of wine from my friends just to kind of, or trade it or whatever, but because I think that's really important. But yeah, I mean, her cellar's arguably better than mine. Mine is sort of more, I also hide mine. Like mine's kind of at the winery, in the back of the winery, kind of cloistered off where you have to actually make an effort to get to it. Hers is just kind of downstairs at the ranch. So it's sort of like, probably should grab a bottle. So we're probably depleting hers more than mine, I guess, which is fine.
Fine by you.
Yeah, exactly. Fine by me. Exactly.
Have you seen anything during this time of the pandemic that might give you some hope or optimism, or think that maybe we're going to do something in a better way in the future?
One of the reasons why I make the wine that I do is because of how much time I did spend in the beginning part of my career in Napa, and how not talking any kind of shit about Napa, because I really think that they're, for people on the outside, it's hard to explain how much money and time and effort has been spent on Napa to sort of refine their work to such a point. But my hope is that sort of the people that were pricing their wines on the basis of what their neighbors were charging and using that as an indication of quality, I hope that that sort of insane mindset, I hope that that's going away. We just need some kind of correction where, you know, all these baby psalms, when they do come back to work, that they still can afford to taste some of this stuff. And that when restaurants start refilling their caves, that there's some semblance of reasonable prices out there. And I hope that that's a correction that stays.
I hope so.
How we price wine is so crazy sometimes. It is so crazy. And it's meant to be drunk. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I hope that that sort of continues and that more people get to taste good wine.
Do you think that that's an issue mostly with, you know, when someone buys some land in Napa Valley, spends $a few million on that, $a few million on a house and a winery and an expensive, you know, winemaker and all this. And, you know, in order for it to be a viable business, you have to charge a ton of money versus like in Loire, you know, your family owns that land and the house and you're paying everyone.
Well, I've said this a million times, but like price doesn't make terroir, right? Like it just doesn't. And you could say Napa, but you could say Sonoma Coast too now. I mean, look, if I wanted to buy the property adjacent to Jasmine and I need to find $20 million and like, that doesn't make it good. Do you know what I mean? What makes it good is sort of this history of producing quality wine year after year. And I think that like that sort of model of like, you know, I made my money elsewhere and I'm spending $10 million, $20 million, $40 million for this piece of property, ergo, it's going to produce a $250 bottle of wine. That logic makes zero sense. And one would argue that, you know, Champagne certainly has a similar problem to Burgundy does as well, although I think the classification system helps that. I think Barolo, one would argue that the pricing there sort of drives that too, but you can't force someone to buy based on what you think your value is. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not how the market works, right? And I think people have been able to get away with it through marketing, through all sorts of other things. But I think that this has been a reckoning for a lot of folks. And I don't know that that's a positive. It's certainly not optimistic. But I think that there's some, if that correction sort of lasts a little bit, I think that would be helpful for a lot of other people in the business.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, one of the things about your wines, and you know, from the Monkey Jacket to the more expensive ones, is that they always feel like good value.
Right. Right. I mean, that's
been over deliver. Yeah.
That's been my thing from the beginning. And I think that, like, you know, again, financially, that's probably not the smartest maneuver on my part. But for me, that's been such an important marker of my wines that, like, I care more about that than I do about having a nice car. My old Subaru is fine. I don't need a better Subaru.
Yeah, I don't think you should do this. I'm not saying you should, but I always had the sense that even with the Ultramarine, your more expensive wine, you probably could have charged more for it. It was in such high demand.
The only time I get upset about that, when somebody writes about Ultramarine and then they put the list price as whatever price they found on WineBid or when they Googled it or whatever, right? And they put like 150, or the other day, somebody from some paper in Florida wrote $240 for a bottle of that wine. Oh. And I was like, guys, I have literally never sold a bottle. Well, that's not true. The late disgorged Ultramarine, I do think we had that for 120, maybe. But that wine was on lease for 7 years. But like, I've never sold a bottle over $75 or $78 or something like that. So like, I don't know. Just put the retail or my release price. That's all I really care about. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I could have sold it for more, but you know, 6 years ago, I thought we weren't going to be able to sell any of it, period. So I'm very happy for what people are paying and I'm very, very happy for the demand and I'm fine with it.
Me too. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's
been such a pleasure to chat with you.
Joe, it's been great.
Well, that was a great conversation with Michael Cruz. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed speaking with him. I want to give you guys all a big thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, anywhere you listen to podcasts. And if you subscribe, I'd really appreciate that as well. I want to give a big thanks also to Jessamine Molly of Seaplane Armada and to Palaner Selections, who distributes the cruise wines. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with a new season of In the Drink in the near future. I'll keep you posted on my Instagram at Joe Campanelli. And if you have any questions, concerns, suggestions, feel free to shoot me an email at inthedrinkpod@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you.